Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate.
Now listen to this. I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopeless night, the meager food from gold for God. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
I'm feeling kind of lucky tonight. She's a little pup there. Oh! Yeah, Bruce, do it. We're bopping. A little final dancing. Final dancing! Ba-ba-ba-ba-da! Come on, here it comes. And a career is launched. Yeah. Not so dancing. Big man, stand it up. So welcome to another exciting edition of Turbo Time. I'm your host, Dr. Mark, and I'm the call to participate in the program, which I would be shocked and amazed if you did, is still 646-478-4847. That's 646-478-4847. Oh, is it really November 10th? It should be like November 50th. I feel like I've aged a month in a week. I'm on the show. I'm on the air again. I don't believe I'm on the air again. You know, I did those two shows last week, and by the time I went for the second hour of the second show, I was sick of talking to myself. Tonight, we will actually have another voice out here to bounce ideas off of. See, because you guys don't call this program. You listen to it in secrecy. I know you do, because I see the archives. You're listening. I'm going to open the damn chat room tonight. Let's open it up. I know you vultures are in there with your little comments. You never wanted to ask a question on the air? Come on. I'm sitting here. Come on. What do you got for me? Ah, the world is spinning, folks. There's volcanoes erupting. There's all sorts of controversy anywhere you look. It's November. You know, it's the month of just ruckshot as we head steaming towards the full moon on the 21st and go into this new cycle here. We're right in the middle of the fall. Believe it, the 7th on Saturday, or was it Sunday? Sunday was the actual middle of the fall coming out of the time change. And I'm still picking up the bodies over here on Myrtle Boulevard in beautiful downtown Larchmont. People are losing their ever-loving freaking minds out there. Change the clock an hour, gets a little darker, we get closer to the holidays, got a couple of weeks where the kids are home once or twice a week, gets a little tense. We get the family hijinks season starting this weekend. We're in the middle of the first week of pineal season. Well, you know, I don't talk much about the pineal here on the air. You guys wouldn't know what it is. If I said pointy a pineal, you'd think I was saying something obscene, probably. You rat bastards. Know nothing. Anatomically ignorant. I swear to God, I used to do this back when I cared. I used to stand on the corner on Went Avenue in Larchmont in my scrubs, tie-dye scrubs, and I would hold a $100 bill in my hand. Now, back then, I had $100 to hold in my hand. And I would say, if you can point to your spleen, I'll give you this $100. I'd be there 45 minutes. No one could do it. They know what a damn spleen was. They point to their chest. They point to their heart. I don't know what they were doing. Oh, the spleen over here. It's on the 10th rib on the left side. You know the stitches you get when you run a little bit? That's spleen under there. I can't believe people don't know where their spleen is. And I think for the most part, people don't understand the way their body is designed. They don't understand the way their body functions. Now, last week I gave a little pontification on what the four domains are, which is my work. It's my work, Daffy. So, you know, I think I feel like not talking for a couple of minutes and playing that for you because I really want to drum it into your little minds and open up your minds. Not all you have little minds. Some of you have two big minds. With this idea that I have that I think should spread like wildfire amongst the masses, that if you stop thinking that you have a brain that lives in isolation, your brain is a social network that is on a biological scale. It is operating at other frequencies even. It's picking up channels that you couldn't even afford. Music of the spheres, for example. I'm getting really woo tonight on a file on Wednesday. Wow. And I really feel like I want to do this because we're going to go on a map quest tonight that's going to blind you if you don't get this stuff that I'm talking about. So I'm going to play myself from last week talking domains because I think I actually made some sense. I didn't plan on doing this. I had a couple of things I got to do, but this is just as good, seeing as it is my show still. Oh, first I have to play this clip from a Family Guy that my brother sent me as a little skag on the team I root for. Hang on for this one. Uh-oh. Wait a second. Why would this diabolical YouTube do this to me? Look at this. Look at this son of a bitch.
I'm being... Shh. Oh, Halloween's a...
Stop it. Yeah, rat. Okay. It's only 9 seconds long. Believe this?
Saw Halloween's a bigger letdown than being a Mets fan.
Opening day, and here's the first pitch, and the season's over.
I gotta hear that again.
Saw Halloween's a bigger letdown than being a Mets fan.
Opening day, and here's the first pitch, and the season's
Wally Backman watch, and I'm not letting that go. As soon as they name him, I swear to God, there'll be a parade in this office. I can't stand it. The way they diss my Wally. Wally Backman. He made it the second round of interviews, by the way. We will have Mike Silver on the air the night of the name of the manager, and we will review the future of the New York Mets. Maybe we'll play that clip to introduce him. Here's the first pitch of the season. And the season's over. Gotta love it. Oh, man, it's funny. Oh, God. All right, now I'm searching for the clip I played. Oh, my God, look at this. You know, I post a lot of things I don't even remember posting. Wahee-hoo. All right, here we go. This is the one, explain where the Florida Mains are, right? Okay. Okay, we're going to go there, and we'll play it. A couple minutes. I think it's like 2 minutes, 3 minutes. But I want you, I'm going to introduce this topic every time I want to talk about these things. You bastards have to know what they are. Otherwise, what the hell's the point? What the hell's the point? The revolution.
I don't know what the Florida Mains are.
Wait a minute, Flippy. All right, here we go. Flippy, talking Flippy.
I will give you a 90-second crash course. When you're born, you must bond with the maternal unit in order to survive. This entrains an awareness called neuroception. Neuroception is the nervous system being aware of itself. Once that happens, you feel safe. And once you feel safe, you can then grow. Okay? So the first year of life, you are in a philo-species-oriented attention. Philo-somatic. Biosomatic. Humans and my body and my surroundings, right? Because all soma is, right, is, and they say open body, but don't pay attention to that. Somatics is the science of the relationship between self and surroundings. So first year of your life, the priority is to philo, to bond, right? Second year of life, more bonding. Now it's about me. I shift my attention, as I learn to walk and eat and do things independently, to myself. I start to self-regulate. I become ontosomatic in my attention, primarily. And then the third year of life, again, it's a relationship. We did self, now we'll do surroundings. We started out with other, then we went to self, now we go to surroundings. That's the eco-somatic year of your life, third year of your life. And that's when you get your emotional cues of other things that are going on. The tone of a room, temperature, light, all these other environmental triggers that the casinos are very fond of, make you eco-somatic in your attention. I pay attention to my surroundings and I respond. Fourth year of life, big brain change. Now we can actually compare events. We can predict and remember and lie like rugs. And we get outside our soma. We become cognitive for the first time, really aware of our thoughts. A proprioception of thoughts occurs. So neuroception now is advancing itself. And now we begin to generate a worldview, which by the end of the fourth year of life, 80% of it is hardwired. We become exosomatic. We have systems and tools and beliefs and all these different filters that will now homogenize our experiences. Only 9% of us have our clearest year in that fourth year. 68% of us, that first year, when we're a bunch of footnets, firewall. And the rest, onto Anika, 12 and 11% respectively. Okay? So there's your four domains.
Okay? So there's your four domains. It's like Joe Pesci there. All right? I needed to do that. I don't know why. Maybe because I'm going to start launching into a tirade here in a minute. But if you didn't notice it, you know, in the wake of the election, there's a little fallout on the Pinko side. When they unceremoniously suspended Keith Olbermann for basically backing his position and, contributing to some campaigns of some Democrats. I think two out of the three of them won. I'm not sure what the heck happened. Anyway, big, bombastic, stupid gesture of, oh, we're going to suspend you indefinitely. He's out 2 days. He's back on the air last night, you know. Anyway, Jon Stewart had a little fun with it. So here is Anto John riffing on Eco Keith. It's pretty good. Pretty good. I like it.
We're free to disagree. That's the great thing about America. We all have the freedom to have our own opinions and say and do what we wish.
MSNBC has suspended Keith Olbermann from making political donations.
Almost everybody has that right. It seems on Friday Keith Olbermann broke an MSNBC rule by making campaign donations without first obtaining permission from the network. Because MSNBC has a hard and fast rule that political donations represent bias in journalism unless you ask first. You learn your manners, boy, or I'll knock you down to hosting headliners and legends so fast your head'll spin. Anyway, Olbermann was suspended indefinitely. I mean, it's bad enough they already suspended his mustache. Boom! Boom! Oh, that was gratuitous. Anyway, suspended indefinitely. There's no telling how long it'll be till we see Keith Olbermann again.
MSNBC says Keith Olbermann will be back on the air tomorrow night.
Lesson learned. Yes, MSNBC. It's a stupid rule, but at least it was enforced poorly. Now, while we were all focused on the infighting at MSNBC and myself and Stephen Colbert, I wonder what's going on at that other network that doesn't suspend or fire their employees for backing political candidates, but instead goes ahead and hires the actual candidates, thus cutting out the middleman. What's on their minds?
There's been a lot of focus on the president's trip to India and throughout Asia.
Big controversy as to what the real cost of the trip is.
It's going to cost about $200 million a day for this entourage to go.
$200 million a day? 3,000 people?
As much as $1 billion for the trip.
$500 million. It's going to be somewhere around there.
Some people say that it is up to $2 billion for 10 days. Is that true?
I don't know.
And how many ships will be there?
34 warships, possibly.
I don't know.
He's just saying, by the way, that was television's Glenn Beck, acting as always as Fox News' voice of reason. But before we all rush to judgment on idle speculation about how much it costs, why don't we just consult someone whose grasp of these ever-increasing figures comes with no equivocation or uncertainty. Someone like radio's Glenn Beck just 3 hours earlier.
So he's traveling with 34 warships, an entourage of 3,000 people, $2 billion, 34 warships, $2 billion to go over to see the Festival of Lights because the president says he wants to experience it.
Thank God TV's Glenn Beck doesn't ever listen to radio's Glenn Beck. Has anyone checked out where these numbers come from? I bet Fox News Follow the Money guy Eric Bolling is on it.
It's a trip equipped for a king. A president, 40 planes, 600 cars, including the Barackmobile, you know, the beef, the entire Taj Mahal, 570 rooms in all, an entourage of 3,000 people, 3 choppers, 30 bomb-sniffing dogs, a total cost, $200 million a day.
Okay, two things. One, the Taj Mahal isn't a hotel. And two, 40 planes, but only 30 dogs? That doesn't make any sense. Who's going to fly the other 10 planes?
Can it be a rough plane? Oh, I don't know. What are you doing?
In Fox's defense, it is a confusing story. And if you want to debunk these figures, you would have to call somebody with an outside line.
This trip doesn't cost $200 million a day.
Some 34 ships and an aircraft carrier in support of the president's trip to Asia. That's just comical.
Just to put it in perspective, it costs about $190 million a day to execute the war in Afghanistan.
That $200 million a day figure, where'd that come from? Well, that was in a quote by an alleged Indian provincial official.
Oh, my God. Fox has been outsourcing even their bull manufacturing jobs. This is crazy. More on the president's trip to India, we go to Asif Manvi, who joins us live from New Delhi. Asif, these reports that the president's trip to India is costing $200 million a day. Mm-hmm. Apparently, all this can be traced back to an Indian news story citing an anonymous source.
John, this whole thing can be chalked up to a simple cultural misunderstanding.
I get it. So what you're saying is someone confused 200 million rupees with dollars and the number, because actually 200 million rupees is about $4.5 million.
John, the original story clearly states $200 million. The mistake was for Westerners to accept the first number they heard.
I don't, now
I don't follow.
No, well, this is India, John. Over here, the reporter opens with a wildly inflated number, right? Then the haggling begins. The news consumer says, 200 million a day? Do I look like I just fell off the mango truck? I will give you 5 million a day. To which the reporter then says, 5 million a day? This is the president of the United States. The head salami. No, no, no. 175 million is the lowest they would go.
Look, Asif, I'm familiar with haggling and the concept of haggling. But these are news facts. I'm sure the Indian News Service does not put its facts up for barter.
Well, okay, John, I see that you are a very shrewd news consumer. You're
what?
Very good, and you are my friend, sir. The truth is, it's not for international stories, okay? Domestic stories is what they do. This was a domestic story for them, which is why they used haggling.
Asif,
right? Obviously, hey, look, I get it. You're looking for something from a correspondent that I don't have, all right? So you go find that. Good luck to you. I'm going to go. I'm walking out. This is it, okay?
All right, well, thank you, Asif. That's...
I'm sure I'm going to get fired for this, okay? But it's local stories, okay? You happy now? You're killing me here. Come on. We only do it for local stories. Boy, what they say about Israelis, I swear.
I'm not Israeli. That doesn't...
Come on.
All
mean,
right. Thank you very much,
Austin.
We'll be right back.
All right. There you go. Little John Stewart riffing on the news. So you go from the ridiculous with Keith getting suspended.
Being a leader is moving fast.
What is this thing doing?
Across the country, when the economy tumbled...
Will you shut up? There's so many commercials on these dopey things. Ugh. You go from the ridiculous with Keith, and of course, with John Stewart, the whole Bush thing, I'll give the next one. The whole Obama trip, farcical, and now we go to the fantastical, which is this dopey... a Bush Decision Points book, where he just basically makes up crap and puts it between two covers and sits there and spits at Oprah. So, here's... I can't take this guy anymore. Do you even remember how bad it was 2 years ago with this chuchuchin that won the White House? I mean, I know everyone hates Obama now because he's so bad and evil. But this stuff that Bush pulled... And he just lies. And you got to realize he's a philo. He can't lie. His face gives it away. He's giggling as he's lying. Everything he says is a lie. And then he lies to himself by lying to you. The man can't tell you what time it is without lying. He's so full of crap that even when he thinks of something to say, he's still lying. Oh, he makes me nuts. So he writes this piece of crap book. And everybody tries to get him to look at a mirror or something, and he won't do it. So, here's this Joe Wilson guy who was one of the many victims of Bush's just absolute, I'll just call it reign of terror. He always liked talking about terror. He okays waterboarding in the book. It just never stops how much crap this guy can put out. But I'm glad he's gone. I'm glad. You remember that sign a couple years ago? You missed me yet? I mean, I saw him at the World Series that time. Like, please make this man stop. He thinks he did a good job. He's so clueless. All right, here we go. Hardball, loading up.
Mom, did you borrow my green shirt?
Can you stop it? God almighty with the commercials. Everything's commercials. Anyway, there's a little segment here with Chris Matthews. Chris Matthews talking to Joe Wilson here. And then we're going to get right to our guest. We'll be here in about 5 minutes. And we will stop talking about the past. All right? We'll put away our baseball encyclopedia and start talking about the future. Oh, my God. All right, let's see. Are we going to have an actual clip here? Or are we going to just go? Okay, here we go. All right. Bada-bing. And how about some news?
In Mexico, and also with us at NBC News, well, our top investigative reporter, Michael Isikoff.
Bunch of crap. A couple minutes of this.
Joining us. I saw the film last night. I was inspired. It is a great film. I'm going to talk about it later tonight. I thought it was so well scripted, so well acted by Naomi Watts. Perfect as your wife. I thought Sean Penn my friend, was you. I tell you, those people were great. Let me show right now something much more important. That's the issues behind the film. On WND, the president is writing now, quote, "No one was more shocked or angry than I was when we didn't find the weapons. I had the sickening feeling every time I thought about it. I still do." What's your reaction to hearing the president say that, Ambassador Wilson?
Well, I think Mike Isikoff, who has reported on this far more extensively than I do, probably has a better take. But it was very clear to me, and also to Valerie, it has been for a long time, that whether there were weapons of mass destruction or not, that was not the rationale for going to war. That was the excuse they used to mobilize support. They wanted to go to war because, for whatever reason they wanted, whether it was to redo the politics of the Middle East, as Bill Kristol has said publicly, or to bring democracy to the Middle East, or to overthrow Saddam, whatever it is, it had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. I was in Europe at the military command when we were doing the no-fly zone over the north. At that time, our generals were saying, this was in the mid-90s, that it wasn't worth the amount of time and money we were spending on it because there was no threat coming from there. That threat level didn't change from that time until the time we went to war.
Mr. Bassett, that is my view entirely, but you're the reporter on this case. What did the president do when he heard there was no weapons? Did he act as if that wasn't the reason he went to war because it wasn't all that important to him? How did he act?
Right, look, that quote, which is probably the biggest news bite in the book, did leap out at me because David Korn and I reported on this when we wrote the book Hubris, and I think you've got the quote.
Right.
But David Kaye, who was...
There he is, David Kaye, weapons inspector David Kaye, describes the meeting in which he told President Bush about them, these not being there. Quote, "There was no sign of disappointment from Bush. He was at peace with his decision to go to war. I don't think he ever lost 10 minutes of sleep over the failure to find WMDs." So this book is not an honest recounting of what happened.
Well,
he didn't go to, Ambassador Wilson says, he didn't go to war over the WMD, so he wasn't shocked that they weren't there. You're reporting.
All right. Just to flesh out that quote, that comes from a passage in Hubris where we're describing David Kaye briefing Bush for the first time in July of 2003. The guy, David Kaye, had been sent there to find the WMD, and he's for the first time telling Bush, "I don't think we're going to find what you told the country we're going to find." He's trying to be gentle about it, but he's being complete.
And it didn't really bother Bush.
He leapt out at David Kaye that Bush hardly reacted at all. He showed not the least bit of concern.
Ambassador Wilson says that this was really a sales pitch. It wasn't the real reason for the war. Let's take a look at a clip from the film. As I said, a fine film, whatever your view of the war, though, if you were against the war and were suspicious about the reasons given for fighting it, you will particularly enjoy the way it's laid out here. Here is a clip from the film Fair Game, where Valerie playing. This is the part where she learns she's been outed as a CIA agent. Let's listen.
Wilson never worked for the CIA, but his wife...
As an agency operative on weapons of mass destruction. He just went ahead and did it.
Does this run overseas?
It's in the newspaper, Valerie. It's on the...
No, that's Colin. Is he syndicated overseas?
Everywhere.
Well, the number of people that had a hand in outing her, you could argue, in terms of reporting to the press, were, as you know, Michael, you were one of the reporters that knows all about this. Fleischer said something to Pincus, Rove said something to Novak, Libby said something to Judy Miller, everybody, and of course Armitage said something to Novak and Woodward. So there were a lot of people out there talking.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it was, look... Dick Armitage of the State Department was the first one to disclose Valerie Plame's name to Novak. But the White House jumped on it very quickly on their own before Novak wrote his column. Rove was confirming it to Novak, and Ari Fleischer got out there and called Walter Pincus out of the blue and dumped this information on him. So there was definitely and Judy Miller got it from Scooter Libby. So there was definitely a White House effort to use this information for whatever...
To destroy Joe Wilson's wife.
To try to discredit...
Ambassador Wilson, your view, watching the film and putting it all together, what's the historic importance of this to the country? I mean, 20 years from now, a kid in high school, boy or girl, trying to understand how we got to war with Iraq, a country that never attacked us, after we'd been attacked by Al-Qaeda, which had been comprised basically of thugs from Saudi Arabia, some Sharpies from around the world, but nobody from Iraq. How do you explain we went to war with Iraq?
Well, I think you've asked two questions. One is about the film, which I think is a timeless story of power, the abuse of power, and how one stands up to limit power. And it goes back to the time of the drafters of the Constitution, at least in our country, when power and what to do with it was the central question and led to separation of powers, led to co-equal branches of government, and the enshrining of the First Amendment. With respect to the war in Iraq, I think it's very clear, and I think in the president's own memoir, it becomes very clear that they were absolutely committed to overthrowing Saddam Hussein, and any piece of spaghetti they could get to stick up against the wall, they were going to use to justify it. And the easy case to make that everybody that was going to put the fear of God into everybody was this whole idea that we could not afford to wait for a mushroom cloud to come, or a smoking gun to come in the form of a mushroom cloud. And that is the whole nuclear case, all of which was built on out of whole cloth. And I think you see that in the movie, in both the Yellow Cake story and in the aluminum tube story, which Valerie was involved in.
And some more, the president has put, quote, inaction would have had consequences to imagine what the world would look like today with Saddam Hussein still ruling Iraq. The chance of biological, chemical, or nuclear weapons falling into the hands of terrorists would have increased. Instead, as a result of our actions in Iraq, one of America's most committed and dangerous enemies stopped sending us. Well, the weapons he described, the chemical, biological, nuclear, hadn't fallen into the hands of Saddam Hussein yet. I mean, this is the outrageous part of this. Sure, we have to worry about weapons all over the world. I'm worried about former members of the Soviet Union, those engineers over there that actually have weapons. They exist. Not one of those guys selling one.
Right.
And I worry about people in Al-Qaeda who have money and educations that float all around the world that could do this.
Well, Saddam did have a chemical biological weapons program years earlier. And it was discontinued, during the early to mid-1990s and never resumed. The concern, and talk about evidence that was fabricated, the idea that Saddam was transferring weapons or sharing chemical and biological weapons with Al-Qaeda terrorists, that ranks right up there with the nuclear program as something that was based on the flimsiest intelligence report.
Let's take another look at the movie, and then we're going to quit this, because sure. I think this is an attempt by President Bush now in this new book to try to play the game that he really cared about weapons of mass destruction, that was really the reason we went to the war in Iraq, and he was so flabbergasted when he heard there weren't any weapons there. When we've now pointed out, because of evidence there from David King, he was never flabbergasted. He was never disappointed, because by all evidence, and as Ambassador Wilson just said, that's not the reason we went to war in Iraq. It wasn't the weapons of mass destruction. And in fact, you read during the time anybody followed this story, that was the sales pitch to Europe to try them to get in on our side. That's why we ended up with the Coalition of the Willing, because Europe looked at us and thought we were nuts. In this clip, by the way, let's take a look at Valerie Plame, played by Naomi Watts. She's fabulous in this, after she's left the CIA. Let's watch this great scene.
I went to the agency and I requested security to protect my family. I was declined because, quote, my circumstances fall outside budget protocol. If this is a knife fight, sir, right now we're fighting it alone.
Joe Wilson versus the White House, huh? But I feel, as a friend, I should tell you that those men, those few men in that building over there, are the most powerful men in the history of the world. How much of a stretch do you think it would be for them to take on Joe Wilson? Joe is out there on his own, Valerie.
Ambassador Wilson, I watched that movie. I was so stirred by it last time with my wife and my son. And I have to tell you that I did think, going back over the minor part I had in covering this and being involved to a very slight extent, trying to figure out exactly what it was like to be on your side of this thing, to know that you had the White House, the smartest people in the political caravan of the president, spending day and night figuring out how to screw you. What did that feel like?
Well, yeah, it was all about survival. I frankly don't know how else one should respond. I suppose you'd go underground, but it was very clear, as you hear from the movie, one of the quotes was, "We're moving earth movers over Joe Wilson." So it was very clear what they were doing, and it was either fight or flee, I suppose. And at the end of the day, if you don't have your reputation, you have nothing. So you might as well fight for it. But I really think that if I were to sort of offer a lesson out of this movie, it really is that if Joe Wilson can stand up to power, then anybody can.
All right. As usual, the computer is doing its deal, so I'm going to have to cut out of that. And let's see if we still have a... oh, there it is. So the summary for that entire piece...
You filthy criminies.
There you go. And as a segue, here's our friend Paul. All right. Paul Garcia was here to save me. Oh, my God.
What was that all about? That sounded like Chris, it sounded like Chris Matthews.
Yeah, I was playing the clip of him interviewing the Paul Wilson and the whole, not Paul Wilson, Joe
oh,
Wilson.
Oh,
and the,
Joe Wilson and
the
Valerie
reaction
Plame.
To the book.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is something that we could probably touch on because a lot of the stuff that you cover with your work has both a head and a tail to it, where events from the past tend to resurface.
Absolutely. You know what? I got to tell you something interesting about that. But before I do that, let me just make mention to those of your listeners who'd like to actually get a look at some of this stuff. I wanted to give out an email address and tell them that if they drop me a line, I will pop off to them an enormous package of background material, including the booklet "How the Future Happens," which we normally sell for like $12, and I will send you the PDF of that as part of the package as my gift to your listeners. Or they could go to the website and download it themselves. But the email address is Merlin Project. That's all one word, Merlin like the wizard, Project, Merlin Project, no spaces. @gmail.com, MerlinProject@gmail.com, I'll get that package of material off to you. Also, if you're online and you're listening, you can go over to our Time Track Library, which is located at Time Tracks, that's TimeTrakS, no C, .org, Time Tracks, TimeTrakS.org, and you can actually look at some of these. The package I sent you tonight, Mark, though, is not posted online. So if they want to get a copy of the Time Tracks we're going to be talking about tonight for the next hour or so, they can drop me an email and I will get them off to them, and they can see what these things look like. What's interesting about what's going on right now is that this is 7 years and about half a year, something like that, from Bush going into Iraq in the first place. And when that happened, the night of the invasion or incursion or whatever you want to call it,
shock it all,
which was March 19th of 2003, we issued a set of time tracks on the war. And we George and I had some problems with this because he's very well connected into the Pentagon, and he had been given a look at some of this WMD, this manufactured evidence, the kind of stuff that Colin Powell presented to the UN, where he did not come off like Adelaide Stevenson, who had the real thing, as it turned out. But anyway, George had a look at this intelligence, and he and I were on completely opposite sides of the Iraq incursion. He was convinced that they had WMDs and so on and so forth. So being that we're in the prediction business, we had to get together on what we could agree to. And using the time track for the initial incursion into Iraq in March 19th of 2003, we were able to agree to say that if they didn't get it right at the beginning, that is, in the first several months up to maybe a year, that this thing was going to drag on all the way out to 2011, at which point we got laughed at by practically every other pundit out there, and a lot of the radio and TV hosts that we visited with over the intervening years. Well, of course, now we know better. And if they go to the Time Track Library and they take a look at Bush's run and Cheney's run that are posted there, it's clearly obvious that Cheney was actually pulling all the strings, and that Bush's entire legacy is going to turn out to have been invading a country that didn't do it and getting reelected. That's going to turn out to be Bush's entire legacy, beyond the fact that, you know, he ran us into the ditch economically, and he managed to, you know, to take a $900 billion surplus and turn it into a $1 trillion deficit. But what's really interesting from a time standpoint is that we're 7 years and half a year, roughly, down the road from having done this. And here he comes out with this book, which is chock full of let's call it, if we're going to be nice about it, we could call it revisionist history. And even the Brits and lots of other people who are mentioned in there have jumped up to disagree that this is just not true and not what really happened and so on. And what I can't understand is why he thought he was going to be able to revise all of that, go out on a book tour, and not be taken to task for any of it. And what, it's just unfortunate from an electoral standpoint that he didn't release the book about 2 weeks ago. Because if he had, not only would a lot of these Tea Party people that I thought were going to go down in defeat went down in defeat, but I doubt seriously the Republicans would have taken back the House, much less the Senate, because we would all been reminded of what they did the last time around. For those people, you know, I think I told you that my favorite bumper sticker in the 2004 reelection campaign was the one that said, Bush, Cheney in 2004, and thanks for not paying attention.
Well, we're not going to uncover all the paper trail about how they rigged both elections. I mean, I'm waiting for that.
I agree. From somebody who's in the business of watching numbers, and people don't understand that the kind of work that I've been doing all these years, and certainly the kind of work Dr. Hart does, is there's no mystical mumbo-jumbo about it. I mean, we call this thing the Merlin Project just because Merlin historically, or apocryphally, let's put it that way, allegedly had this ability to see down the road quite a bit, but had a real problem seeing what's right in front of his nose. And that's really the take on Merlin, essentially. While this has a kind of, you know, surrealistic or magical kind of ring to it, it sort of seems like high tech witchcraft or something. What it really is math. It's a kind of fancy mathematics that turns time into a tide table, except that we're able to reduce it down to a timetable for individuals as well as for countries and situations and so on by taking the arrival moment, the starting date, what we call the genesis date, and using that as a kind of mathematical starting point for a series of cycles that are going to crest every so many years. So in the case of the Iraq War, for instance, the two biggest crests so far would have been at about 9 months. That was when we figured out that mission wasn't accomplished. And at the 7.5 year mark, which is where we are right now, and it stands to reason that Bush would be coming out with a revisionist history right about now of what went on. And the problem is, I don't know what it is with politicians these days, Republican or Democrat or Independent or whatever their political stripe is, they don't seem to have grown up with an understanding that there are such things today as videotape. And we can go and Google, and we can go back and we can find out not what they're saying they said, but what they actually said.
Does it every night. It plays the clips.
Well,
you
it's
know?
So different.
We've all become a nation of Meet the Press.
Well, almost, except that one of the things that people forget about is that, and I was mentioning this to you last time around, that the actual number of people who are invested in the, let's call it, politics as sport is really a very small percentage. So in other words, the number of people who listen to Limbaugh and Hannity and watch Oberman and, you know, and Rachel Maddow and Glenn Beck and so on, even Bill O'Reilly, is really a very small percentage of the population. It includes mostly only people that actually go out and vote, but even so, it makes up a very small percentage of those. And the people, the rest of the population, the rest of the voting population, doesn't really start paying attention to what's going on in a political year like we've been in until maybe, you know, 2 weeks before the election. Then they start saying, all right, now let's see what these referendums are, what got put on the ballot, whether it's pot in California or in my case here, whether they're going to pay to pick up trash by buying plastic bags at the supermarket, or whether they're going to raise the tax rate to do that. And while we all figured out, the smart ones of us, that it was cheaper to buy the bags and recycle everything else, the dumb people won, because the dumb people said, well, this is going to reduce, we're not going to have to buy these plastic bags. Well, yeah, that's true, but your tax rate's going to go up umpteen dollars, and what might have cost you $100 a year in plastic bags is now probably going to cost you $300 to $500 a year in an increased tax rate. So you didn't save anything. And there's a lot of that that goes on because, you know, we now live in a population of lots and lots of dumb people. One of the times we were on coast to coast doing this, George Norrie said to me, he says, you know, Paul, he said, if everybody paid attention to this thing that you and George have discovered, you know, there'd be days on which doctors wouldn't operate and days on which planes wouldn't fly. Doesn't that bother you because of the upset it would cause? And I said, yeah, I'd worry about it if it wasn't for the fact that we are not going to run out of dumb people and who won't pay any attention to it. And they're in the majority, unfortunately, these days. There's more of them, and I think, frankly, it's attributable largely to the fact that kids today don't study history, certainly not with the attention that you and I would have, and consequently, you know, my ex-wife, who was 18 years younger than I am, back umpteen years ago when the anniversary came around, after listening to, you know, all sorts of references to it, she finally said to me, so, what is this D-Day thing anyway? And I looked at her like she had two heads, and I said, you don't know what D-Day is? And she said, well, you know, when I was in high school, history was an elective. Well, you can't run a country where history is an elective. Any more probably than you can run a country where English isn't the official language, or at least where you're required to learn it if you're going to come here, which I think is a kind of minimum requirement. I mean, these enclaves of people that don't speak English are getting bigger and bigger, and it's not a racist thing, it's just common sense. You know, you shouldn't have to go to the polling place and see the instructions printed in 18 different languages.
It's up to sale, because what happens as a result is that it sort of dislocates the citizen from his culture, because his culture becomes sort of undocked in a way, and the amount of barriers that they overcome to communicate increases, because you have to constantly sort of reset everything to address every minority, every faction, to make sure you're politically correct and doing it all at all times. And you live in this sort of soupy, you know, digital sort of river that becomes sort of chronoscopic rather than chronological. We live in this turbine.
There's also something else that's very, very basic, and that is when your parents or grandparents or great-grandparents, depending, probably grandparents, came here, they were in a gigantic hurry to shed, you know, all of their ethnic stuff from wherever they came from.
Right,
they wanted to be Americans. Excuse me?
Yeah. They wanted to be assimilated into the culture, yeah.
Right. The reverse is true now. They want to come here and they want to move into their little enclave and speak Vietnamese or whatever it is. And, you know, not to single out the Vietnamese because it's everywhere. but the fact of the matter is that there's a real level of silliness going on when it comes to that. I mean, you know, you go to France and they don't require you to speak French, but you damn well better learn it because they ain't going to deal with you if you try to speak to them in Vietnamese. Unless, again, you're in an enclave. And I think the enclaves here are more stridently ethnic in a lot of ways than they are in a lot of other countries because I think they get more permission with all of this, you know, English as a second language. And, you know, it ought to be English as a first language and wherever you came from ought to be the second language, not the other way around. And there's very little of that
because,
kind of thing.
Because
of
the political climate, like you're saying, now there's a pandering to each one of these factions to get their vote.
Absolutely. And you know, not only is there a pandering to the ethnic groups, the most obvious at the moment probably being Latinos, but there's an enormous amount of pandering, at least on the right, to their right. So in other words, one of the things that the evangelicals finally admitted after 8 or 9 years of Bush and Cheney was that they were promised all kinds of things if they got the vote out for them, which they consistently did. They were promised like $1 billion worth of money for all sorts of projects and whatnot, and things to help the poor and so on. I remember the fellow that ran the giving office in the White House. He's an Asian guy with a three-letter last name, and I can't think of what it is right off. But anyway, he wrote a book. And the book basically outlined the fact that they'd been scammed, that instead of getting $1 billion in aid set aside to help the evangelicals, you know, do their various things, they ended up getting $16 million. Well, mm-hmm. There's a huge difference between $1 billion and $16 million, like huge. And, you know, in the 2004 election, Rove got these gay marriage amendment things or referendum things on all these ballots just to get the evangelicals to come out and vote, and by the way, also vote for George Bush. So the reason for getting them on the ballot was not because they believed in any of that, but because they knew it was a good scam to get these evangelicals to come out and vote, which they then did. You know, in talking about those two elections, yeah, if you're a numbers guy like I am and you actually know the way exit polling is done, and I applied to go to work for CBS back in the, hold on for a minute, in the 68 election, I applied to go to work for them because they were going to do something in 68 that nobody had ever done before. They had cooked up this thing they called vote profile analysis, which translated into the very, very first attempt to do exit polling using sample precincts. Sample precincts which reflected the ethnic and economic and so on profile of the entire state. So they could find a few sample precincts in New York or New Jersey or wherever it was that essentially represented the breakdown of the rest of the state in terms of blacks and whites and Hispanics and you know, educated and uneducated and who how many master's degrees and how many people dropped out in sixth grade and all of that stuff. They were able to find sample precincts that could do that. And by using those sample precincts, they could figure out what had happened in the state with as little as 1% of the popular vote actually counted. because they were doing their own polling of people leaving the polling places in those sample precincts, and they knew how many of, you know, how many whites to ask and how many blacks to ask and so on. And consequently, for 30 years, from 1968 to 98, using more and more, you gotta remember, in 68, we didn't have laptop computers and all of this. We had, right. We didn't even have TRS-80s. We had nothing except mainframes and no portable computers of any kind, storage problems, et cetera, et cetera. So they were doing this vote profile analysis with the Model T version of the computer, essentially. And from 68 to 98, using ever-increasing versions of the programs on ever-increasing more exotic computer systems, they were able to get every single national election and most senatorial and gubernatorial elections absolutely right until we got to the election of 2000. 2000 was the only time in the history of doing these exit polls when the exit polls turned out to be wrong. And I use wrong, advisedly in quotation marks. Because there's certain things they had discovered over 30 years. And it was even more clear in the 2004 election, because anybody who cares to check this out can go look it up. In 2004, in the early afternoon, Kerry was leading in the exit polls that were being done at, say, noon, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, the only thing unusual about that is that it was classically known at that point that even if the Democrat was going to win when all the votes were counted, because Republicans tend to vote early and Democrats tend to vote late, that in the early polling, say, the first 4 or 5 hours, so from 8 until noon or 8 until 1 or something like that, you might get something closer to being even, or even have the Republicans showing a slight edge because the Democrats hadn't come out to vote yet. So by 1 o'clock, you might see a 2 or 3% push for the Republican, even though the Democrat was going to win by 10 or 12 percentage points by 8 o'clock when the Democrats got out to vote. So for Kerry to have been leading in Ohio at 1 o'clock in the afternoon by 3 or 4 percentage points, it makes absolutely no sense by the entire science by which they do that. And exit polling is not a crapshoot. It's a science. Okay, it makes absolutely no sense that Bush could possibly have won when all the votes were counted at the end of the day, because Democrats always vote late and Republicans always vote early. Therefore, Kerry could not have been leading with 3 or 4 percentage points at 1 in the afternoon if he was going to lose
and
that
lose.
State. Okay.
Why didn't they really contest it, knowing that
that's the other thing. The difference between them in Ohio was about 250,000 votes, maybe 300,000, somewhere in that number. And there were 500,000 to 750,000 absentee ballots that hadn't yet been counted, and by law in Ohio, they couldn't be counted for 11 days. So the vote had to be over for 11 days before they could open and count these absentee ballots. So Kerry had absolutely every reason to sit on his duff and do nothing for 2 weeks and just wait to see what happened. And in the meantime, they could poke around and see what other funny business might have been going on, you know, machines counting backwards and all sorts of other stuff.
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of voter fraud. Those black box
machines
were
out there. But you really have to wonder why he threw in the towel at 2 in the afternoon the next day, unless either he had some early warning of John Edwards' infidelities, which is possible, or, you got to remember, Bush and Kerry were among a very, very small fraternity of people who were skull and bonesers at Yale. I mean, the number of people that were in skull and bones at Yale, you could practically count on both hands and feet. That's a minor exaggeration. But I think the total number since that club was formed is maybe up in the 1,500 range, something like that. Not in the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, but thousands, maybe 1,000 or more. And Skull and Bones is one of those. It's actually, you know, it was actually the early, growing ground. That's not the word I want, but early, you know, percolation sort of for the CIA. The OSS and whatnot was Skull and Bones people. And I've always thought that was mighty peculiar that Bush Jr., so W, and Kerry were both Skull and Bones, and they weren't there at exactly the same time. Kerry was there, I believe, or maybe they were at the same time, but not in the club at the same time, or something like that. But I think you only get into Skull and Bones when you're a senior. And Kerry was, I believe he was 3 years older than Bush. I think he's a 43 and Bush is a 46. So he was there. He would have been getting out the year that Bush would have been maybe a sophomore at Yale. So there isn't much chance that they were in the club at the same time. But Skull and Bones is of the fraternal organizations on campuses, Skull and Bones is unlike any other. It's got all of these odd little ties into things like Bilderbergers and what's that grove? I can't think of what the name is, but maybe the group of high end. Mostly
what, Illuminati?
No, not quite as exotic as Illuminati. I'm thinking Coconut Grove, but it's not Coconut Grove. It's something Grove, and I can't think of it. Maybe some of your listeners know. But anyway, they are part of that hierarchy that always seems to be running everything. So it's very interesting from a time standpoint that Bush is coming along at exactly the time frame we would have expected him to, that is around seven and a half years later, and giving us his revisionist history of what went on. I can't believe, though, he's going to get an easy time of it because, the record is the record, and we know a lot more about what went on there than we knew at the time. He's still talking about it as though we didn't know any of those things.
It's almost like he doesn't understand that he can't riff or he can't,
spin it anymore.
Digital history. It's right there. You press play and
right.
There it is. And I think in his delusion, in his bubble, he thinks he can do it and get away with it.
Well, he seems,
I haven't seen too many interviews where he's comfortable doing it.
Well, I was surprised, very, very, very surprised, that the first person he allowed to do an interview, I think it was the first, if not the second, maybe a second, I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether 60 Minutes was first or not. But with Matt Lauer, because people don't give Matt Lauer the respect that he deserves as an interviewer. He's not intimidated by anybody. He'll look you straight in the eye and ask you a really hard question, and if you start, sort of waffling around, he'll hold your feet to the fire, and he's one of those people like Ted Koppel who'll say, well, yeah, that's very nice, but you didn't answer my question. Let's try this again. People don't do that with presidents and ex-presidents, by and large. I mean, I've watched Brian Williams, for instance, interview Bush or Obama, for that matter, and there's a lot of deference going on there. But
even Oprah, to me, is kind of a softball interviewer. She gave him a hard time too.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know, he's written a bunch of stuff in there that just isn't true, and we now know that it isn't true, or suspect that it isn't, at least. You know, and there's so many bits and pieces that, you know, that you can shoot at him with. I mean, he had such an awful 8 years in terms of creating any kind of legacy, a positive legacy anyway. You know, there's no legitimate reason for having invaded Iraq, and there's no legitimate reason for the data mining that was going on with the NSA and our phones.
It's a litany of F-ups. I mean, you can go from that,
absolutely.
You can go to election, of course.
That's right. No question.
You can go to Katrina. I mean, what do you want?
It's literally a litany. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. And if I had been him, you know, I would have laid low for quite a while. Let Obama get firebombed over various things in here and kept a low profile, not reminded people of what a screw up I was.
I would have been off the planet.
Absolutely.
Jimmy Carter is a perfect example. Jimmy Carter became much more palatable to the American psyche 10, 15, 20 years after he was out of office.
That's right.
As an ex-president, right. And that's the way an unpopular president can have a legacy, because you can't do it based on your record. Your record is torturing us, literally,
right.
Now.
And you certainly can't come back and remind us about it this soon when there's this much information. You know, I mean, and there's so much come out. There's so many people who've come over to the other side. You know, people who were speechwriters, people who were higher ups.
Ex-generals. Everybody's throwing them under the bus. I mean,
absolutely. You've literally got everybody.
Yeah, exactly. I think his karma's set pretty good. Let's turn our attention to the time tracks here. On the preview of the show, I actually uploaded the how to read the time tracks onto the site. So you can go over at summerspace.org/timetracks.html, and it explains everything about Merlin and about how to read these time tracks. But basically what I wanted to get across to people is that Paul Garcia from the Merlin Project, is that when you look at the typical way people think of the future, whatever map you're using, I mean, there's a lot of maps. I mean, you could go astrological, you can get the I Ching out, any of these divination type of things.
Right.
And then you have this digital version that you're doing. The difference is that this is a topography. This is not a flat map. This is very similar, actually, in the somatic sense, to how we look at the seasons unfolding and recurring. So it's a recurrence analysis, if you want to get mathy about it, that we use, you know, when we look at heart rate variability. And there's a lot of things that get embedded in time. And when you look at any event or any individual's life, there's a rhythm to it, and people only understand it, it seems, in retrospect. This is giving them a way to look at things as things are emerging and coming towards them, so they can anticipate the terrain rather than get their knees cut out from under them. So
it's the ability to see what the future is going to look like as a kind of topographical map in advance.
Yeah.
You see where the hills and valleys are going to be, in which years, and for how long, and so on, and how frequently.
Right.
And you can see if there's going to be a group of years, let's say, in your own life or in the history of some event. Because for our purposes, there's no difference between an individual and an event, because both have a birth date. They both have a genesis date. The event has the date it occurred, and the individual has the date they arrived here and started interacting with the universe, or this universe. And consequently, what we're doing is we're displaying a picture of what that's going to look like as this kind of, you know, map of hills and valleys and so on. We could actually turn it into a 3D, which would be kind of interesting. Or as George once said, we could turn it into a visual sort of ride, so you could take a ride on your life, basically, like a roller coaster, sort of. And you'd be riding up and down the hills and valleys. And boy, I'll tell you, if you were in a bumpy period with lots of hills and valleys in it, you'd know it, because if you were riding on it like a 3D visual, you know, a virtual reality kind of ride, boy, would you, when you got through that period, you'd know you'd been in a bunch of years where all hell was going to break loose and things are going to be changing around you rather rapidly. And that's what we look for when we're running these. So, for instance, in the group of runs I sent you, I sent you Sarah Palin, and I sent you Christine O'Donnell and Rand Paul, and I sent you
Tiger Woods here.
Now, if you compare Tiger Woods' run with any of the others, okay,
he's the only
one that even has a smidgen of a similarity, and that's only really in the current period, is Rand Paul's. The others are fairly desolate, which means to me, and I've sort of had a running argument with Dr. Hart about this, but it means to me that people like Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin, who incidentally, if you look at those time checks carefully and you look at the genesis date of each of them, you're going to discover that Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin are born in the same 24 hours.
Wow.
They are time twins.
Yeah.
They are time twins.
Palin is 2/11/64 and Glenn Beck is 2/10/64.
Yep.
Look at that.
Same 24. Doesn't that tell a story all by itself?
Well, yeah.
I mean, you're looking at the two ringleaders, basically, of this, you know, Tea Party thing, which I'll tell you something. You know, people are saying, oh, my God, if the Republicans take over the House, you know, well, there's a pretty good chance they weren't going to take over the Senate, but pretty much thanks to Sarah Palin, because she she got candidates to win the primaries that were going to lose to the Democrat when the mainstream Republican who was running would have beaten the Democrat. So Sarah Palin is largely responsible, right, for the GOP not having won the Senate. But anyway, the interesting thing about Palin and Beck and those people is that if you take a look at those time tracks, you have to come to the conclusion that in the larger scheme of things, they are nothing more than a blip, a sort of interruption in the constant, and they are at best maybe an extended 15 minutes of fame, if not only 15 minutes. Because what's going to happen...
They both go bye-bye here. It looks like they both go bye-bye pretty soon.
Right.
After this year.
And one of the reasons why is the Republican mainstream is furious, absolutely crazy furious, that because of her and her nonsense and Beck and his nonsense and some of these other proponents of the Tea Party people, they not only are saddled with these people in Congress, which is going to be fun and games for the next 2 years, but not only that, but they lost the Senate because of these people. If people like Christine O'Donnell hadn't been the candidate, they would have captured the Senate, chances are. But Palin, you know, is riding this wave as though she's done really well. No, she's actually done very poorly, because where it really mattered in terms of getting senators elected so they could take over the Senate, because the likelihood of taking over the House again would have been pretty good sans the Tea Party, just because it's the midterm elections, and the party that's out of office generally does very well in the midterms and often picks up 30 or 40 seats, and the Republicans only needed 39 to take over the House. So therefore, they probably would have taken over the House without the help of these Tea Party people. But the Senate, they had a really good shot at, and that would have literally, you know, crippled Obama.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen is because of Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck and some of these other people. And I was very amused by the fact that John Stewart Stephen Colbert managed to get two or three times as many people to show up on the Mall for their Saturday than Glenn Beck did.
Right.
The interesting thing there is that, well, Beck's people and Fox, you know, estimated the crowd at, you know, 300,000 to a half a million, but CBS had hired a company that's in the business of doing that. They're in the business of head counting, because the National Park Service doesn't do those estimates anymore. They don't want to deal with the grief. So CBS hired a company that does visual counting, basically, from above. And they estimated the crowd for the Beck event at somewhere between 70 and 90,000. And the estimate by the same people for the Stewart event was about 200,000. So
Bill Maher said they were the same weight.
Two or three times. So excuse
Did
me.
Get that?
Oh, that they were the
Bill
same
Maher
weight.
Bill Maher said that the crowds were the same weight, even though there were 70,000 in fact. 200,000.
That's probably true. Yeah, no. Things are getting a little more risque on Bill Maher's show, because I don't know if you caught it.
Oh, yeah. He's got people
Fridays
smoking pot on the air. He's really
apparently, it was actually a joint. It was the real joint. Which I thought was hilarious. I've never seen anybody smoking a joint on live television.
I think we're at the stage now where we're so disenfranchised from the government that it really is at this point. We're all, in a way, almost from every faction, thumbing our nose at this stuff because the puppet show is over. When Christine O'Donnell, the witch here, you know, when I look at her time track, from 2012 to 2016, it seems like both on the internal and on the external part of the time track, which you talk about on that description page I mentioned,
external realities
and internal realities, she's got a lot of intense stuff going on, which means that she might become, because she's attractive, because she's a little eccentric, the next person that Fox imports to exploit and sort of inject into the conversation.
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
As Palin goes away in the wind.
Right, the sociologist's take on this whole Tea Party thing, especially Palin, has been that Republican men think they're hot.
Yes.
And women by and large, they need that. Yeah,
the one in Minnesota.
Yeah, Fox
and the other one, they're all the same. They want that that MILF white mother. You know, that reminds them of when, you know, everything wasn't so multicultural and they could control the universe. And they just found another one, the Christine O'Donnell, who's a party.
I'll tell you what I'm a little bit concerned about, though. Here's my current concerns. Mike Bloomberg, mayor of New York, in his third term, because he got the city council to... to basically rescind the two-term limit.
Strong arm
that And now he wants the two-term limit reinstated for the next mayor. I think that's hilarious. But anyway, Bloomberg is considered running as an independent in 08 and didn't run, as I understand, because my kid was pretty well connected into that non-campaign. The reason he didn't run was that he didn't want to rain on the parade of the first viable Afro-American candidate, and therefore didn't, is seriously considering running in 2012 as an independent. Now, we all know that independents don't win presidential elections, and then nobody has.
No, they just split votes.
Well, here's the what's worse than that, though, this time. Because if he were to do that, and let's say, for argument's sake, Palin managed to get the nomination because she muscled everybody all the centrist people in the GOP who are scared about losing their job because they're not pure enough, got the nomination. And that's probably not impossible. I would say the chance of Palin getting the nomination, running and then getting the nomination is as good as 1 in 3. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 70% of the voting population, whether they're Republicans or Democrats or independents, have been polled, and they all agree that she's not qualified to be president. However, there's enough of a nucleus of right-wing Republican, you know, Fox watchers to get her the nomination if she really, you know, twists arms and pulls strings and whatnot and reminds everybody of what happened to the people who weren't pure enough in the last election. Not that that would happen again necessarily, but it happened already once, so she could certainly use that. And gets the nomination. And now you've got Obama running against Bloomberg and Palin. Now, with that little triumvirate, it's likely that nobody's going to get enough electoral votes. So what happens?
And you're going to have like 92.
The election gets thrown into the House of Representatives, which now is top-heavy with Republicans, a number of which are Tea Party people who haven't yet been voted out of office when we all figured out they were nuts. Okay.
This is like the perfect nightmare.
That could get scary. Now, there's a scenario. And that's a scenario that's worth paying attention to. Because Bloomberg's already made noises that he might do this. He didn't want to do it to Obama the first time around, but he's not very happy with the way Obama's handled the financial end of things. Although, for all intents and purposes, given what he arrived with, I can't imagine how anybody with a brain in their head would look at the last couple of years and say, well, he could have done more. He could have done better.
Yeah.
Or he could have done differently, you know. Imagine if he had gotten in like McCain and cut tax rates or something instead of bolstering the Wall Street banks and whatnot. We would be in the second Great Depression right now, and with McCain having had four episodes of invasive cancer, not just some benign thing, but metastasized skin cancer, he could easily have gotten a reoccurrence of that, just given the stress that would have been going on for him. He would have been 72 and a half. He would have been 72
right.
and a half, and he might have had to take a leave of absence, and we would be stuck with Sarah Palin right now in the middle of a depression.
Now. Oh my God!
I mean,
can you imagine that when the BP spill happened?
Well, they bitch about Obama. Oh, Obama, this one. Think about it, folks. Yeah. You could have had Sarah Palin as president right now, and that's not an extreme position. That's just looking at the facts that McCain had cancer four times. He said he didn't know anything about economics. He made a clear statement. I don't know anything about economics, okay, any more than he knew anything about the Internet, okay? And anybody who could have picked Sarah Palin as a running mate needs to have had their head examined. McCain is actually embarrassed by having made that choice and refuses to say that he thinks that she would be a viable presidential candidate in 2012 when he's been asked repeatedly. Okay.
He got
talked
out of Lieberman, right?
Excuse me?
Was he going to pick Lieberman?
Who? Oh, yes, that's what he wanted to do. Yeah, he wanted to pick Lieberman. He got talked into Sarah Palin because she was really red meat for the extreme right wing, and he was never trusted by the extreme right wing in the first place because of positions he'd held and deals he had cut with Ted Kennedy and, you know, Feingold and various other people, and the fact that he was for campaign, you know, financial reform and so on. McCain was never trusted by the right of the Republican Party. So Sarah Palin was a way of making sure
that
he...
Look at Bush did to McCain in 2000 in South Carolina.
Well,
I don't know how he could have party loyalty to those guys.
Well, because, you know what, Republican men seem to have this ability to put the swords aside at the door and cut deals. Okay, it's one thing that women don't seem to be able to do, and Democrats
especially Hillary, right, with her Puma people.
Well, exactly.
Remember the Pumas?
Yes.
Party unity my ass.
Oh, yes. I still think that Hillary and Obama cut a deal. And I look at the Merlin runs and stuff, and while it doesn't confirm it and say yes, absolutely, it certainly indicates it that, you know, somewhere near the end of his first term, he will either do a switcheroo and get Biden to step down and replace him with Hillary, and have Biden take over the State Department as Secretary of State, and then he'd have Hillary running as his running mate in 2012 with the eye towards setting her up for at least her own legitimate run in 2016. These people that think that Obama's going to get challenged, I doubt that seriously, okay?
Who would Bloomberg run with? As a
vice president?
As a running mate.
I have no idea. He'd clone himself. I don't know. I do know this, though. Bloomberg is 1942. He's a February 1942, which is going to make him, hold on a second, let me get this right, he's 68 and a half now. It would make him over 70 when he'd be running, and in 71 when he would get into office. And we've pretty much found that people who are around 70 don't make it. McCain didn't, Bob Dole didn't, Reagan was not sharp in his second term, certainly the latter half of the second term. There's a very good reason for not nominating 70-year-olds for the presidency, because they're starting to fall apart anyway. And, you know, I mean, look at Obama already. He's graying out. He's got lines in his face he didn't have. If you look at the Obama of 2 years ago when he was running, and he ran hard.
They look 15 years apart.
I don't know about 15, but they certainly look 8 or 10.
Oh, he's gray. He looked like I hate to say it, but blacker in 2008. He looks pale.
He looks like he needs a sandwich. That's true. If I were him, I would have not allowed it to gray out. I would have colored it. I would have, because I think that to some people, when you start to gray out, they start thinking of you as older and more feeble and whatnot, just because that's the way we operate. I mean, I'm plagued by the problem that John Bolton, that recess appointment, UN representative Bush that Bush stuck
in
there. Remember Bolton?
That guy.
Yeah, Bolton,
yeah,
who
oh, yeah.
has
riot,
hair color is, whose hair color is fine, but he has his mustache is whited out. Well, I got the same problem.
Yeah.
It's not even gray; it's white. Okay, he's got a white mustache with sort of sandy blondish, slightly graying but very slightly hair. I've got the same problem. I've got a few little, just a little bit of gray on the edges of my hair, and if allowed, a mustache that comes in very white, and it looks stupid. So I color the mustache, and plus my kids, you know, get on my case about coloring. It's like, Dad, you got to color that because it looks stupid, you know. Well, it does look a little silly, frankly, with the mustache one color and the hair a different color. You kind of have to wonder when you look at that, is the guy coloring his hair and forgot to color his mustache? Okay, so...
Yeah, exactly. But, it becomes a little bit of false advertising.
Right, but in any case, this period of time, given those time tracks for the Tea Party, mm-hmm. some of the heads of the Tea Party, and if I had included Sharon Angle, the one that Harry Reid, and I was, I think, the only pundit that I know who thought Harry Reid was going to recapture his seat. Angle's run looks very much like that. Miller's run up in Alaska looks very much like that. Buck's run out in Colorado looks very much like that. And those are basically the creme de la creme of the Tea Party candidates, along with Christine O'Donnell, that Palin was pushing. And they all lost.
Yeah. I explained Jerry Brown in California
Senate,
real quick.
They all lost Senate seats. They lost, you know, yeah. Angle oh, lost.
She's shotgunned the entire effort that the Washington right was trying to effect. And now they have to deal with this sort of, I hate to call it grassroots, whatever the heck it is, this outside the beltway movement that is very good for the culture war, but very bad for governing, which is
well,
why when I look at California,
great,
and I see
it's going to be great fun though to watch the Republican hierarchy, the Mitch McConnells and the John Boehners.
Yeah, they're
going
to have to go after these people
to try to keep these people in line. For instance,
yeah,
I mean Gingrich found out back, you know, 14 years ago, or not 14, 16 years
yeah.
ago, that if you shut the government down, you piss off all of these seniors and people that rely on the government for, you know, for their livelihood at this point, you know, veterans, disabled veterans,
yeah.
People who, you know, who not the ones who have been on unemployment for a year, but the ones who went on unemployment last week. Okay, all of those people, veterans benefits, senior benefits, Medicare and Medicaid and what, all those checks just stop. And it's probably part of the reason that the Republican Revolution of 94 that took back the House and the Senate from Bill Clinton ended up crashing and burning, and it's the reason that Bill Clinton won a second term in 96, because people don't like the government to shut down and lay them out in lavender because they don't have any resource, basically, to fall back on. And these Tea Party people have already said they're not going to extend the continuing resolution to fund the government. And if they actually do that, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if they did, and Bloomberg doesn't run, and there isn't that nightmare scenario I was talking about earlier, I will tell you right now, Obama gets reelected. Period. End of story.
I totally agree with you. I think that the one interesting thing about that, just give me 30 seconds on Jerry Brown. He's another older guy. Been around
well,
a lot.
Jerry Brown, you know,
he beats out Meg Whitman.
You know, Jerry Brown is one of the few politicians, Fred Thompson was another one, where I got their birthdays from them. When Jerry was running for president back in the early 80s, he was on Alan Combs' show, one of Alan's shows. I don't remember where Alan was at that point, but anyway, I wanted to get Jerry's birthday, and it wasn't as easy as it is now to go to Google and find it, you know, or Wikipedia to find it. You know, getting these birthdays is sometimes a problem. So Alan said, why don't you come by? Jerry's going to be my guest this afternoon. So I showed up, and sure enough, he was, and we got a chance to chat, and I got his birthday. And Meg Whitman with all of her money, okay, which when the dust all settles, I'll bet out of pocket it was $150 million at least.
I don't know whether
you saw this, but the one of her last commercials, in an attempt to be not negative, okay, she did this commercial where she waxed poetic about how great California was when she first went there 30 years ago, and full of opportunity and all this other stuff. Well, you can bet that that commercial was written by an under 30-year-old who didn't realize that Jerry Brown was the governor when all of that was going on.
Right. That's what I was going to say. Jerry Brown was the governor. Thank you.
And the Brown people, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall at Brown headquarters when they saw that Whitman commercial and started laughing hysterically, because all they had to do was run her commercial for the first 30 seconds or so and then stop it cold and say, well, you know who was governor 30 years ago? Jerry Brown.
I endorse this commercial or something.
Absolutely. For all of that money that she spent, that commercial shot her in the foot like nothing I've ever seen. That was one of the great screw-ups in political commercials in the last 50 years. As best I remember, he's a 1938, early April, like the 7th or the 8th in there someplace. And he's held just about every major political position in California that you can hold. And he is a very savvy guy. So I would suspect that Jerry Brown's going to get the California finances in some kind of shape again. Not that Schwarzenegger didn't try. I was actually impressed with Arnold. I've always thought that Schwarzenegger was a very smart, very shrewd guy who arrived here with no money in his pocket, married a Kennedy, okay,
and ended up
about as high up as you could go without getting without running for Senate. And I'll tell you, if he had run for Senate this time, instead of Meg Whitman, he probably would have won.
Maybe we'll find out the next time through Schwarzenegger,
I have a feeling that Schwarzenegger would have pulled that one out.
Maybe we'll get a chance to see it next time through.
You know,
we're going to wrap it up. So one thing we did learn tonight.
But he was 10 years. He's also 10 years younger than Jerry.
People vote for the face. Yeah.
That's right.
Well, one thing we did learn tonight, there's a surplus of dumb people, and they're probably not listening to the show right now, but maybe if they listen back, they learned some stuff about time tracks. One more time, give the email address if they want to get all the package from you.
Sure. If they'd like, and this is a very exotic package of material. Believe me, there's a minimal amount of advertising in there and lots of really good reading material. If you'd like to get a package, the only way you can get one is to actually drop me a note, because there's no way to download. And you can download some stuff at the website, but not the package. Yeah, send me a request and just send it to Merlin Project. That's all one word, Merlin Project, @gmail.com, and I'll get that package off to you. If you'd like some information about arranging an appointment, there's an 800 number. It's actually an 866 number. It's 866-298-7688. Let me give it to you one more time. 866-298-7688. And we'll get some material off to you.
All right, Paul, thanks again. Always great information. We'll get you on again, around the end of the year there. Either one side of New Year's or other, kind of see what's in store as we get this new Congress in place and hang on to our hats for a couple of years.
So it's always fun to talk to you, I'll look forward to doing it again.
All right, be safe. Enjoy the holidays. I'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Thanks. You too.
Take care. All right, here you go. Paul Garcia. Wow. My ears are spitting. I don't even know what to say. Except goodbye, because we're going to be back next week, and I think we're going on the healthcare trail. I don't know if I'm going to get that elusive guest from the ELISA Corporation, or we'll see, from the Coherence Conference.
But I think I'll just sum it up with a little talking heads tonight. And we will see you again next week. Thank you very much to our guest, Paul Garcia, from the Merlin Project. Dr. Mark, thank you for this time and your space. Be yourself and be well. Travel light through the darkness here.
You may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. You may find yourself in another part of the world. And you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. And you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Fire on, sapiens.
And you may ask